abstract when he emailed me and I said, you know, I've been in this administrative gig for the last 4 years, this month actually is 4 years, that the last BIF meeting that I had the opportunity to attend was in Columbia, Missouri. And at that time I was leaving Pfizer to go to this role. And that was my last opportunity to interact with BIF. So when he emailed me, I said, what the hell would I have to say to BIF? Because I haven't thought about this hardly in 4 years. And this area. So I hope that isn't too evident in the next 15 minutes. But I do want to share a few thoughts with you that will maybe set a little context here for the discussion you're going to hear from Daniel and from Mike and Matt and Scott, you know, and the genesis of how we got here and what the steps were to get to this era in genomics and application of genomics. Many of you probably were here last night and heard the really good talk that Steve Kappas gave in the U.S. MARC Symposium that was quite detailed in history and talked a lot about the steps that really were taken all the way back to PCR development in the late 1980s and how we moved from that over the course of the following best part of 20 years to get to the sequence of the cow genome, to get to the beginnings of applications out of that sequence development. And I'm not going to reiterate all those steps, but I want to provide a little context around some of it for you that will hopefully help you understand some of the following speakers' comments. I distinctly remember, as a graduate student in the 1980s, a lot of discussion about the upcoming DNA revolution. And I happened to be kind of one of those folks, along with two of these others that are here. Daniel and Mike were coming through graduate programs at exactly the same time. I think we actually finished within months of one another with our PhDs in different institutions. And we remember really well, if you were studying in genetics at that time, and in quantitative and population genetics, this discussion that was out there about the possibilities that might emerge from new technologies that were coming out of molecular approaches and being able to visualize DNA-level information at the nucleotide level, or sort of at the nucleotide level, for really the first time. And Steve talked about that last night. The development of the polymerase chain reaction in 1987 was really the piece that set that into action more so than anything else that has happened since. And I finished in 1989. And I distinctly remember trying to look for jobs in academia in quantitative genetics applied to my love in beef cattle, and where that was going to be as a field. And there was a big discussion that was started at that time about reinvestment of resources, especially within the university system, not just in the U.S., but around the world, away from quantitative genetics was the trend, the movement then, away from quantitative genetics toward this new molecular era. And what could we do with the development of markers? What could we do with the opportunities that those markers might provide for the industries long term? That's late 1980s, okay? So 25 years ago, you kind of see the analogy of the title of the talk here. And I guess I should also mention, I gave this cheesy title to the talk, gave that to Jack. And the reason I did was I played the Wizard of Oz in a theatrical production a couple of years ago, Wicked production, and so I thought, you know, let's just dance down the yellow brick road. So there won't be any more cheesiness than that to it. So I was trying to come up with a nice name for the topic. But it was 25 years ago, roughly, that we're talking about here. And then we hit 1990, and there were discussions occurring in amongst some of the leading geneticists at the time about this idea of linkage mapping. And what could be done if we could place enough markers, as Steve talked about last night, what became known as microsatellite markers, into a physical map of the genome, in order to begin to see if we can mine that information. And you're going to hear from some speakers today that were integrally involved in that, involved in the first development of those first maps. And Steve talked last night about the two of them coming out in the scientific literature, one from CSIRO in Australia and one from the U.S. Meadow Research Center here in Nebraska, that were literally published within months of one another, similar levels of density of coverage of these maps with these microsatellite markers that unleashed a big period of optimism, I will call it, amongst the scientific community about what we were going to be able to do to be able to find large single gene effects or traits that were difficult to measure. Remember those discussions at DIF? Things that we might be able to get at for the first time. I was one of the people saying that. Get at for the first time because we didn't have phenotypic data at the level that was required in order to make the kind of change we wanted within the EPD structure. Now also place in context of that, that EPDs, as we know them today, were maturing. They were just maturing at that time. The technologies that we were using in mixed model development, the reduced animal model, the ability to do bluff, the ability to apply that to phenotype pedigree databases, that was just then happening. It was just beginning to mature for us to be able to do that with the traits we had phenotypes on in large enough scale to happen. So that was the tension, you get the tension in the system that was there. There was this, what's a quantitative geneticist going to do for the rest of their life? And I remember debates about that here at BIF. I remember Larry Benishek talking about it. I remember some of the scientists from ARC talking about it. I even remember in graduate school, Gordon Dickerson, who we talked a lot about last night. I didn't tell any stories on Gordon, but I'll tell one now. Some of you will remember Gordon passed away in 2001, and the last time the BIF meeting was in Nebraska was in Omaha in 2002. It was about the same temperature and about the same level of humidity. I remember that very well. And there was the symposium, the opening night of that meeting, that was in honor of Gordon. So some number of his former students, Paul Mike Tess, I remember distinctly, Dave Nodder, Larry Kunda, others who spoke at that session honoring Gordon. Well, I'll tell you a story about Gordon being a graduate student with him during this unleashing of tension into the system of molecular genetics. Gordon was well known for pulling out his fingernail clippers when he had a big fall in seminars. It's a characteristic he was well known for, that when something was really beginning to make his wheels turn that was challenging in his thinking, he would pull out his fingernail clippers. Now, most often that was when one of the graduate students didn't know what they were talking about, and he was going to find out whether they knew what they were talking about. But I remember distinctly a discussion on more than one occasion that Gordon had about this technology will not be as simple as we think that it will be. This technology will unravel over a long period of time. It will take us a great period of time to figure out how to use what comes from marker technology without really knowing what it was going to look like yet, right? So this was, you know, in advance of the developments of the technology. And the reason he was saying that was there had been this whole host of brilliant minds in quantitative genetics trying to figure out these interaction terms in the models, right? Epistatic interaction terms, gene-gene interaction terms, you know, forms of dominance interaction terms. We were schooled in that in quantitative genetics. And we hadn't figured out how to deal with it very effectively yet. And now these markers were going to get laid over top of that. And we might be able to begin to unravel that, but it was not going to be simple, was Gordon's comment. And he thought it would be unusual for us to find genes with very large effects beyond defect kinds of things that we're accustomed to. So I make that as a contextual kind of comment around what's elapsed now over the next 25 years following that. Early 90s, microsatellite maps got put into place, a lot of excitement generated. Then there was big push toward marker assisted selection. Remember that discussion? Marker assisted selection was going to offer us lots of opportunity again in these difficult to measure traits that we didn't have phenotypes for. And how might we use that technology? There was a big push during the 90s to develop that approach to marker assisted selection. Investments, heavy investments in Australia in particular with the BCRC projects, heavy investments here in the U.S. in a number of efforts, the Carcass Merit Project, the Angleton Project at Texas A&M that Jerry Taylor and his team led, the development of those initial set of markers that came out of that Carcass Merit Project that was the validation of those markers. Recall that that was discussed at some length last night. We get to the early 2000s. Which is when that was happening, right? And there were some initial commercialization attempts that were putting some of those markers into the marketplace for single gene kind of testing. But the traction for that relative to the value associated with it was relatively low, right? Why? Because the percentage of the genetic variation that's controlled by any of those individual markers was reasonably small within the greater context of the trait, maybe aside from one or two of the Calcasat markers in particular. Everybody remembers that history, right? So here we are in the early 2000s, and some of you will recall that I was with a private venture known as Future B in the early 2000s. I left Colorado State to go to work in that venture, which was a tremendously exciting thing. I told people over and over again I would do it again if offered the opportunity to go back and have that experience again. But Future B had not been successful. It was right after 9/11. And I was looking at what next steps would be. And I had the opportunity to go to USDA and work with the development of the genome sequencing efforts, because it was housed heavily down in the national program area that ARS had asked me to consider leading. And Steve told you that story last night about the writing of the Cal paper, the leveraging of infrastructure from NIH and NHGRI, the National Human Genome Research Institute, the partnering that occurred internationally to bring funds together from USDA. Deb Hammernick sitting back here, she managed a big part of that for the Cooperative State Research and Extension Service at that time, the state of Texas funding that went into that effort, international funding from a number of international partners that went into that effort. And $53 million was pulled together to do that sequencing. And I distinctly remember standing up at BIF, I can't remember where, which meeting it was, being very excited about the opportunities that that sequence was going to afford when it came into place, which happened then in 2006, was when the sequence was published, was put in place. Steve told you the story about the HapMap project that followed that, that many of the breeds in this room contributed to internationally by finding 24 reference sires within their breed. They covered the categories of those breeds for us to be able to look for SNPs, right? Single nucleotide polymorphisms that might be able to be used within and between breeds for now what we were calling genome-wide selection. Genome-wide association and selection. And Steve did a great job, I thought, last night of telling you the story of the 50K, the 60K, the 700-plus-K chips development. And I know you're going to hear about that from some of the speakers here this afternoon, how that actually happened, how it became operationalized, how it began to allow us to build databases. Now, I was at Pfizer by this time, after the HapMap project happened, and Pfizer was interested in what they might be able to develop for the industries in this area, both in genetic selection as well as movement into other areas in the animal health world, animal health business, which they're still engaged in. There's a number of our Pfizer Zoetis, I haven't gotten used to that yet. So a number of our Zoetis colleagues who are here at this meeting. So there's been an effort now commercially, you're familiar with that, over the last 7, 8, 9 years to move some of this technology into the marketplace. Now, I told you when I started out, I've been kind of disconnected from this for about 4 years. I worry about different money. an application of different money. So I haven't kept up with it as closely as I might. So it was really interesting for me last night to re-engage with this group and to hear some of the stories about what's happening in terms of building database, building information into EPD technology, which we knew was going to happen. We knew the markers were going to come back into and merge with. Steve used a quote from one of my papers last night about that. If that's what was going to happen, we were going to come full circle, which we have. We've now come full circle back to incorporation of DNA technology into quantitative genetic approaches. Many of us thought that would happen. That's what's happened. And I was really heartened last night because I wasn't aware that it moved forward as fast as it has. Remember the slide Steve showed last night of the density of the dairy data? He showed the number of records that had been put over top of application of the 50K into variable selection, and now it's moved into female selection as well in the recent years. And his point was the beef industry has to get to that same curve in order to be able to apply this at the same rate that the dairy industry has. They're structured very differently. We are. We all know that. There's one breed that would have that scope of data, other breeds wouldn't. And so when I was at Pfizer, lo and behold, what did we learn? We learned that we were going to have to do this within breeds. And we're going to have to use genome-wide association work within breeds. You know, Dorian Derrick told us we're going to need to train within breeds, right? And we're going to have to develop that database in order for genome-wide association, even with these dense SNPs, very much larger SNP chips than we started with 50K. We thought if we throw million SNPs at it, surely we'll get these done. Well, not really. It's still the density of the data, not the density of the SNPs, necessarily, is my understanding of the field. So we have to do this within breed. I'm talking with one of the breeds last night, I won't name it, who was starting out from ground zero by the time I walked away 4 years ago. And they now have thousands of animals in their database that are 50K genotype, that are connected to pedigrees and phenotype records. And that's that curve that Steve showed so well last night is going to be required for this to have the impact long-term that we want it to have. So that's a little bit of a walk down the path, if you will, some contextualization about what's happened in this field without getting into the new areas, without getting into metagenomics, without getting into what Scott's going to talk to you about with newer aspects of this technology that's now being looked at or used in different ways. Without getting into epigenetics, you know, I walked in and the first thing I heard was talking about epigenetics and what those kind of things were going to mean for us. Point bottom line, we started 25 years ago with something that wasn't so simple. Gordon Dickerson was right, and some of you could fill in Walt Harvey, some of you could fill in C.R. Henderson, some of you could fill in others that would have raise some of those same kinds of hard questions over time. We've come full circle back. We're densifying our data now with molecular data. It will have an impact on early accuracy especially, but we're still going to require a lot of phenotypes. And we're still going to require a lot of information to put with that DNA information in order for it to have its maximal impact moving forward. So that's my little walk down the road to contextualize and open up the discussion for you. I hope it's been helpful. And like I said, I wasn't sure what I was going to say, so that's what you got.